Blog Talk Radio.
Touched by what I like to call the spirit of history. Some force just grabbed us. People had to do something. But people had to say something. If not, I don't think history would have been kind to us.
Everybody has a story, and there is something to be learned from every experience.
Nobody knows your future but you. You're in charge of your own book.
It's very important.
Ordinary people, touched by what I like to call the spirit of history. Some force just grabbed us. People had to do something. But people had to say something. If not, I don't think history would have been kind to us.
Everybody has a story, and there is something to be learned from every experience.
Nobody knows your future but you. You're in charge of your own book.
It's very important that you love and respect yourself first.
You don't have to like a person, but you gotta respect them.
Be human enough to make mistakes and be flawed.
We have to be brave. We have to be bold.
When it looks like you ain't gonna make it, when you feel like giving up, don't.
You can do anything you put your mind to. Believe in yourself. Don't step with anger. Step with clarity.
We are not meant to be perfect.
I don't use the word hero lightly. Congressman John Robert Lewis is a hero. In the turbulent 1960s, young John Lewis stood side by side with Martin Luther King Jr. and other civil rights crusaders, displaying unwavering courage. Through years of continual non-violent protest, John Lewis battled segregation head-on and shined a spotlight on the cruelty of racism in America. Whether he was participating in sit-ins in Nashville, marching for equality in Washington, D.C., taking a stand on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, or proudly serving his district in Atlanta, John Lewis has always embodied persistence, fearlessness, and hope. The son of Alabama sharecroppers, John Lewis grew up witnessing the injustices of the Jim Crow South. It was here that he began his life's work to fight for equality and justice for everybody.
I grew up in rural Alabama, about 10 miles from a little town called Troy. In 1944, when I was 4 years old, and I do remember when I was four, my father had saved $300. And with the $300, a man sold him 110 acres of land. On the farm, I fell in love with raising chickens. When my mother, a father, wanted to have a chicken for lunch or for dinner, I didn't like it. And I would boycott the meal. But the chickens became my friends. And as a little boy, I wanted to be a minister. So with the help of my brothers and sisters and cousins, we would gather all of our chickens together in the chicken yard. They would help make up the audience, the congregation. And I would start preaching to these chickens. I wanted to save the souls of some of these chickens. And I would tell them, I said, be good. Be kind, not to fight. And some of these chickens would bow their heads. Some of these chickens would shake their heads. They never quite said amen, but they tended to listen to me much better than some of my colleagues listen to me today in the Congress. I grew up with, a restless spirit. go off to school, we had the broken down school buses. And all of the little black children had to go down and attend the poorest staff schools. And all the little white children went to another school. I saw the signs that said white men, white women, colored women. I didn't like what I saw. And I thought things could be better. And when I was 15 years old, I heard Martin Luther King Jr. on radio.
We feel that one of the great glories of America is the right to protest for rights.
Listen to Dr. King inspired me. He gave me hope. And I kept up with the drama that was taking place around the country. What was happening in Montgomery and about the Supreme Court decision in 1954. I dream of going to a better school, riding a better bus. I didn't like the fact that my mother and my father, my grandparents, my uncles and aunts didn't have any rights. My mother would say over and over again, boy, that's the way it is. She was saying, you know, cool it, be quiet, don't get in trouble. Well, I was inspired to get in trouble. To get in good trouble. Good trouble is simple. When you see something that is not right, not fair, not just, you have a moral obligation, you have a mission, you have a mandate to speak up, to speak out. You may get arrested and taken to jail. You may be beaten and left bloody. And you could be murdered. You could die. But it's part of the price that you have to pay. Not just to liberate yourself, but help free and liberate others.
We will fight to the last ditch to prevent unwanted integration against our free people. We will fight toe to toe.
Erupted often.
I've been accepted at college in Nashville, Tennessee. By this time, I'm 18 years old. An uncle of mine gave me a $100 bill, more money than I ever had. Gave me a footlocker. I put everything that I own, except those chickens, in that footlocker and took a Greyhound bus to Nashville, Tennessee. I remember so well meeting Jim Lawson, young Methodist minister. He represented an organization called the Fellowship of Reconciliation. He has studied the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence. In the fall of 1959, he started conducting these unbelievable training sessions. A small group of students would come, listen to him, go through role playing. We would have what we call social drama. Because black people and white people couldn't be seated together in a theater. Black people had to go upstairs. White people went downstairs. You couldn't be seated together in a restaurant at a lunch counter. We wanted to change that. We started sitting there on a regular basis. You'd be sitting there in an orderly, peaceful, nonviolent fashion. Someone would come up and spit on us or put a light cigarette out in our hair, pour hot water, hot coffee, and pull us off the stools. We had what we call the do's and don'ts of the sitting movement. If someone push you, don't push back. If someone curse you, do not curse. You wanted to project that it was something that the community could rally around and support. White people cursing, making a lot of noise. These young men and women are just sitting there in an orderly, peaceful fashion. Nonviolence is not the absence of violence.
It is the presence of justice. It is the presence of bringing the dirt and the filth from under the rug, out of the corners, into the open light so we can deal with it. To help convince people who may be standing on the sideline or may be watching that this is the right thing to do. And the city spread around the South like wildfire. If we were told over and over again, if we continue to sit in, we'll be arrested. And I wanted to be prepared if I were going to get arrested and go to jail. I wanted to look what some young people would call sharp, a fresh, a clean. I wanted a new suit to wear to jail. I had very little money. So I went downtown Nashville to a used men's store and bought a suit. I paid $5 for this suit.
We're going to have to show a warrant for your arrest if you don't leave. Is that right? Do you understand that?
Yeah.
On that day, 89 students were arrested. Became the first mass arrest in the sit-in movement. We filled the city jail. And we conducted nonviolent workshops while we was in jail. We sang songs. It created a sense of solidarity that we became one big family. Jim Lawson taught us the whole concept of the beloved community. That this idea that in the bosom of every human being, there is this spark of divinity. That there is this spark of something that is sacred and holy and special, and that we don't have a right to destroy. You know, no one want to go to jail. No one want to be beaten. No one want to feel pain. But you come to that point, and you have what I call an executive session with yourself. That if this is the price, you must pay for people to be free, to be liberated, to be whole. Then we must be prepared to pay that price. When I was arrested, I felt liberated. I felt free. I felt like I crossed over. And I did look clean. I did look sharp. I did look fresh. And I have not looked back since.
Coming up on Masterclass with Congressman John Lewis.
They came toward us, beating us with nightsticks, trampling us with horses. I thought I saw death.
One of John Lewis's boldest decisions was to become one of the original 13 Freedom Riders. The U.S. Supreme Court had already ruled that segregation in interstate travel was unconstitutional. But in many places, those laws simply weren't being enforced. And so in 1961, John Lewis and other civil rights activists decided to get on a bus to challenge segregation in the racially divided South. They nearly got themselves killed in the process. John Lewis knew full well the danger and the difficulty of what he was getting into. But to hear him tell it, the Freedom Rides were something that simply had to be done. He was 21 years old.
The Freedom Rides came into being on a part of an organization called CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality. It was to test a decision of the United States Supreme Court banning racial discrimination during interstate travel because black people and white people couldn't be seated together to travel through Virginia, through North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, to New Orleans. We made the decision with CORE and other groups that we will organize the Freedom Rides starting in May of 1961.
I'm ordering all you niggers to get to the back and stay there. We'll get through nice and peaceful.
Get back, get back, get back.
Hey. I was 21 years old.
Washington, a group of us went to a little Chinese restaurant in Washington, D.C. Now, growing up in rural Alabama, going to school in Nashville, Tennessee, I never had Chinese food before. We had this wonderful, unbelievable meal. But someone said that evening, you should eat well, because this may be like the last supper. On May 4th, we left that morning on a Greyhound bus to go from Washington, D.C., all the way to New Orleans. When we arrived in a little town called Rock Hill, South Carolina, we got off the bus, went into this waiting room, or white waiting. A group of young men, members of the Klan, attacked us, beat us, and left us lying in a pool of blood. The bus was burned in Anniston, Alabama. Another bus was burned and people were beaten in Birmingham. And in Montgomery, Alabama, and Ingram Maud met us at the Greyhound bus station. The first jump of members of the press. So if you had a camera, a pad, you were the first one to be attacked. And then they turned on us. My seatmate on that leg of the ride was a young white student. We both were beaten and left lying in the street, bloody. I had to get a patch on my head. My seatmate was in the hospital. Eventually, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Reverend Ralph Abernathy, came to Montgomery when they heard about the Freedom Rides. They heard what had happened.
The time is always ripe to do right, and we cannot wait. We cannot continue to accept these conditions of oppression.
We had a meeting with them. Said we're going to have a mass meeting in support of the Freedom Ride at the First Baptist Church in downtown Montgomery. There was an attempt to burn the church with more than 1,500 people in the church.
The city is now under martial law, and troops are on the way into Montgomery.
The city of Montgomery was put under martial law, and then we made a decision to leave Montgomery and travel to Mississippi. And going to Mississippi, I had never been there before, but I grew up here in Mississippi. It was worse than the state of Alabama. This is the state where Emmett Till was lynched. This is the state where people came up missing.
The Negro is not a part of my family. As a result, I don't elect to have him sit and eat with me. And we teach our children like this, and they'll teach their children like that.
So the National Guard took us to the Mississippi state line, and you get to Mississippi, the Mississippi state troopers put us in jail. Black and white freedom riders. Then they made a decision to take us all to Parchment State Penitentiary. The guy is standing there with his rifle, and he said, we have niggas here. They will eat you. They will beat you. Just sing your damn freedom songs now. They said to each one of us, take off all of your clothing. It was an attempt to dehumanize us. They segregate us. Put all of the white men in one cell block. All of the black men in another. They did the same thing for the white and black women. And most of us stayed in jail there for 44 days. But the Freedom Ride led to the segregation of public transportation all across the South. President Kennedy, Attorney General Robert Kennedy, was able to get the Interstate Commerce Commission to issue an order, taking down those signs that said white waiting, colored waiting in the Deep South. More than any lesson left learned, you have to be consistent. You have to learn to be not just persistent, but also insistent. And if you see something that needs to be done, do it. It may be hard, it may be difficult, but keep the faith. Hang in there.
This is not
class with Congressman John Lewis.
Demanding passage of President Kennedy's civil rights bill, most far-reaching of its kind in 100 years. And this, during the 100th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation of Abraham Lincoln.
Freedom! Freedom! Freedom!
The March on Washington was the idea of E. Philip Randolph, this dean of black leadership, a man who had been wanting to see a march on Washington since the days of Roosevelt. President Kennedy invited a group of us to the White House to meet with him. Kennedy didn't like the idea. He said, if you bring all these people to Washington, won't there be violence and chaos and disorder? Mr. Randolph responded in his baritone voice and said, Mr. President, this will be an orderly, peaceful, nonviolent protest. And we started organizing. We were able to bring more than 250,000 people to march in Washington. And we all had to prepare a speech. I was very young, 23 years old, had all of my hair and a few pounds lighter.
I have the pleasure to present to this.
When April Randolph said, and I present to you young John Lewis, the national chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
Brother John Lewis.
And look to my right. I saw hundreds and hundreds of young people who had been involved during the early days. Look straight ahead. I saw the sea of humanity. Then I looked to the left. I saw young black men and young white men up in the trees trying to get a better view. And then I said to myself, but this is it. And I looked straight ahead again. And something said to me, go for it. And I opened my mouth and I started speaking.
We march today for jobs and freedom. But we have nothing to be proud of. But hundreds and thousands of our brothers are not here. For they're receiving starvation wages or no wages at all. Those who have said be patient and wait, we must say that we cannot be patient. We do not want our freedom gradually, but we want to be free now. The time will come when we will not confine our march into Washington. We will march through the South, through the streets of Jackson, through the streets of Danville, through the streets of Cambridge, through the streets of Birmingham. We must say, wake up, America, wake up, for we cannot stop, and we will not and cannot be patient.
And some people thought that my speech was a little strong, that it was too radical, but I thought it was a good statement.
Your attention, please.
I have the pleasure to present to you Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
And then Martin Luther King Jr. came up as the 10th speaker. I've heard Dr. King speak and preach so many times, but on that day, he was on fire.
Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi.
He preached a sermon. He turned the steps of the Lincoln Memorial into a modern-day pulpit. And he knew he was doing it.
Singing the words of the old Negro spiritual.
We all lifted up.
Free at last. Thank God Almighty. We are free at last.
The march was all over. President Kennedy invited us down to the White House. He was beaming like a proud father. And he kept saying to each one of us, you did a good job, you did a good job. And when he got to Dr. King, he said, you did a good job. You had a dream. That was my last time seeing President Kennedy. Dr. King used to say, the time is always right to protest for what is right. He also said there's not anything more powerful than the margin of a determined people.
Exercise that right.
Some Negroes charge that they face intimidation if they try to register and vote, that their houses are burned, or they're bombed, or they're threatened with the loss of their job.
There's no intimidation in the state. There's no attempt to prevent Negroes from registering to vote.
I felt then, and I feel today, that the vote is precious. It's almost sacred. It is the most powerful, non-violent instrument or tool that we have in a democratic society. But for many years, people of color could not register to vote, especially in the 11 states of the old Confederacy. People stood in unmovable lines. People were beaten. People were murdered for attempting to register or to encourage others to register. In one little county called Lowndes County, the county was more than 80% African American, just outside of Montgomery, Alabama. There was not a single registered African American voter in the county. After President Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act in July 1964, we said to him, in effect, Mr. President, we need a Voting Rights Act. He said, I just signed the Civil Rights Act. We don't have the votes in the Congress to get a Voting Rights Act. If you want it, make me do it. There was a protest in Perry County, Alabama. A young man was shot and murdered. Because of what happened to him, we made a decision to attempt to march from Selma to Montgomery.
We have a legal and constitutional right to march from Selma to Montgomery.
Someone from Dr. King's organization said, John, we want you to march with us. We want you to lead this march with Jose Williams from Dr. King's organization. We left church. We conducted a nonviolent workshop in a courtyard.
We want some black faces down on Dexter Avenue in Montgomery,
that county. Then we lined up in twos to walk from Selma to Montgomery.
We're marching today to dramatize to the nation, dramatize to the world, that hundreds and thousands of Negro citizens of Alabama, but particularly here in the Blytheville area, denied the right to vote.
I was wearing a backpack before it became fashionable to wear backpacks. I thought I was going to get arrested and go to jail, so in this backpack, I wanted to have something to eat. I had one apple and one orange. I had two books. I had toothpaste. On a toothbrush. But we understood while we were walking through the streets of Selma that the sheriff of Selma and Dallas County had requested that all white men over the age of 21 to come down to the courthouse that Saturday night to be deputized to become part of his posse. We just kept walking. We come to the highest point on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. Down below, we see a sea of blue, Alabama state troopers. We saw all of this water down below in Alabama River. Jose Williams said to me, John, can you swim? I said, no. Jose, what about you? He said, a little. I said, well, that's too much water in this river for us to jump. We must go straight ahead. A man by the name of John Cloud identified himself and said, I'm Major John Cloud of the Alabama State Troopers.
It's detrimental to your safety to continue this march, and I'm paying attention.
This is an unlawful march. Will not be allowed to continue.
You are ordered to disperse, go home, or go to your church.
Disperse and return to your homes or to to your church. That's the major may I have a word, if there will be no word. You saw these men putting on their gas masks. Is there troopers advance?
Troopers here, advance.
They came toward us. Meeting us. Next day. Tramping us with horses. Releasing tear gas. State trooper with a nightstick. I thought I saw death. I thought I was going to down that bridge. I thought it was my last nonviolent protest. And all these many years later, I don't recall how I made it back across that bridge to the church. I do recall being in the church. They asked me to say something to the audience. And I stood up and said something like, I don't understand it. Now President Johnson can send troops to Vietnam. And cannot send troops to Selma, Alabama, to protect people who only desire to register to vote. And the next thing I knew, they'd been taken to the Good Samaritan Hospital in Selma. Where 17 of us had been hospitalized. And early the next day, that Monday morning, Martin Luther King Jr. came by to see me. And Dr. King said, don't worry, John. We will make it from Selma to Montgomery.
Well, maybe some tear gas ahead.
Yeah.
I say to you this afternoon that I would rather die on the highways of Alabama than make a butchery of my conscience.
Yes, sir. Given up. President Johnson spoke to a joint session of the Congress, spoke to the nation, and made one of the most meaningful speeches any American president had made in modern time.
Their cause must be our cause, too. Because it's not just Negroes, but really it's all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice, and we shall overcome.
I was sitting in a room with Martin Luther King Jr. and others. I looked at him. Tears came down his face. And I think we all cried a little. But we knew it was just a matter of time. The Congress would pass the Voting Rights Act, and President Johnson would sign it into law. So I was there. On August 6, 1965, when he signed that act and gave me one of the pens that he used to sign it. My mother and my father were able to register and vote for the first time. My father in particular, he became very, very proud. And I think in places it was dangerous for him to say it, to own me. But he said it. He was, yes, that's my boy.
You're watching Masterclass with Congressman John Lewis.
Dr. King was my hero. Also, he was my friend. He was like a big brother. You know, he gave me a way out. Maybe a way in. But he made life better. just the warmest, nicest guy you ever wanted to meet. He would tease me from time to time. He would say things like, John, do you still preach? And I said, Dr. King, when I'm taking a shower. And he thought it was so funny, he would just laugh. And on occasion, when we would be traveling in Alabama or someplace in Mississippi, you see a little hole in the wall, cafe, a restaurant. He would say things like, we should stop and get something to eat. We get arrested and go to jail, we go on a full stomach. And he thought it was so funny, but I didn't think it was so funny. He had a heart of gold. The day that Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, I was in, Kennedy. It's okay. And I'm gonna go down this road.
Good evening. Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. Dr. King was standing on the balcony of a second floor hotel room tonight when, according to a companion, a shot was fired from across the street. Friend's words.
The day that Dr. King was assassinated, April 4th, 1960, I was working at Robert Kennedy campaign for the Democratic nomination for president. And when Robert Kennedy got up to speak, he said he had some sad news.
I have some very sad news for all of you, and I think sad news for all of our fellow citizens and people who love peace all over the world. And that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight.
Like the many, many people waiting to hear Bobby Kennedy, we all cried.
The body of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., viewed by mourners and followers briefly this morning in Memphis before being taken to Atlanta for burial.
It was a sad and dark hour. I didn't know what was happening to this country, really. And for me, I feel like something had died in America. And I think something died in all of us.
You may have been able to stop the heartbeat of Martin Luther King, but you certainly will never be able to stop the search for freedom, dignity, and equality here in this country.
One of the reasons for getting involved in American politics, to run for office, I felt maybe, just maybe, that I could help continue the efforts of Dr. King. As we would say in the movement, you must continue to pick him up and put him down. You must believe that somehow and some way we're going to overcome, we're going to survive. You may get knocked down, but you got to get up. You dry your tears and keep moving.
Age 49 to 63 and not able to work? This message is for you. New rules in...
My name is Mark DePue. I'm the Director of Oral History with the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library. And today I'm excited to have with me Harriet Tubman. How are you, Harriet?
I'm good. Thank you very much, Mr. DePue, for having me today.
Well, you know, I just heard that recently Sarah Bradford, I believe a good Quaker lady, has had an opportunity to interview you, and she just published a book in 1869 about your life.
Yes, she did.
So I'm going to cover a lot of the same territory that she covered in that interview, but thrilled that you agreed to do this with us, and thank you very much for that.
You're very welcome, kind sir, and I have the book with me.
Oh, my.
This is it. It's a very nice book.
Yeah.
I can't read it. It's a very nice book.
Well, somebody obviously has been reading it. It's already pretty well worn. Wondered if you could start with where I like to start all my interviews and tell us a little bit about your background, and specifically, when and where you were born.
Well, I was born in Dorchester County, Maryland, somewhere around 1820. Might have been 1821, 1822, 1823, because you see, I was born a slave, and nobody cares about a slave having a birthday. But nevertheless, I was born in Dorchester County on Master Brodus's plantation.
Mm-hmm. What do you know about your parents?
Well, I know them very well because they still live with me, even today. We were there as a family on Master Brodus's plantation. My mama's name was Harriet Green Ross, and my papa's name was Benjamin Ross. And we lived right there in a little cabin on Master Brodus's plantation with my sisters and my brothers. We all lived there.
Do you know much about their own background, their own history?
Whose history now?
Your parents.
Oh, the only thing I remember my mama saying was that she was pure African. There wasn't not one drop of white blood flowing through her veins or those of my papa. So I guess I'm African as well.
Okay. How much do you remember about your early childhood?
About the only thing I remember from childhood was not a very good memory, Mr. Depew. But I remember I was watching Miss...
All of us know the name Harriet Tubman, but how much do we know about her remarkable road to freedom? Martha Teichner maps it out for us.
Harriet Tubman, proposed but now on hold as Andrew Jackson's replacement for the $20 bill. What did you learn about her in school? That she ran away from slavery, then risked her own freedom to free others? One sentence, two, if that.
Harriet.
Playing her was tough and exhilarating.
I'm sorry, I'm gonna leave you.
A new film starring Cynthia Erivo.
I made up my mind, I'm going back.
It's meant to flesh out the Wikipedia entry.
When trouble comes, you'll be ready.
I saw her as a young woman who had a force of will that was almost unbreakable, and she was a superhero because of that.
The more you discover about Harriet Tubman, the more you realize she had to be a superhero.
I'm afraid.
To pull off exploits, it would be an understatement to say we're daring.
These are the only known representations in a photograph that we have.
Kate Clifford Larson is Tubman's biographer.
This is 5 feet tall. This is a representation of Tubman as a life-size person.
On the eastern shore of Maryland, where she was born, the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad Visitor Center opened in 2017. This tiny woman who could neither read nor write now has not one, but two national parks dedicated to her story.
Would this have looked the way it did when Harriet Tubman was around here?
Yes, it would have looked exactly like this.
She was born here, Araminta Ross, Minty for short, around 1822. Her parents were enslaved on different plantations.
And that far farm on the other side of the river.
Hours apart.
Minty's life as a slave was horrific. It was brutal. It was cruel.
She and her mother were owned by Edward Brodus, who made $60 a year, renting her out, starting when she was six.
She talked about how lonely and sad she was when she was separated from her mother and how she would cry herself to sleep at night.
And then came the day when she was about 13 that she walked into the Bucktown Village store just as an overseer was trying to catch a runaway.
When the overseer picked up one of these store weights, a 2-pound weight,
join us again next
week as we will dig further into Black history, as we will look at next week. Ella Baker. That's next week. We'd like to remind you that on Monday night we have the Reverend Jesse and Tammy Stewart, and that's at 8 o'clock at 8 o'clock. That's Tammy and Jesse Stewart. At 9 o'clock, we have Minister Leo Killings. Wednesday night at 8 o'clock, we have Reverend Willie J. Vann. Followed by, at 9 o'clock, we have Jason Flex. On Thursday nights, we have the Bishop George Flint, and that is at 8 o'clock. And on Saturdays at 6, we have Apostle Arnold. And right back here on Sundays at 6 p.m., we have Minister Amos Joseph Collins, all the way from Ohio. So join us again next week. We invite you to catch the word. For the word is falling. We would like for you to pray for me as I pray for you. And until next Sunday, we invite you to be blessed.
We are about to speak blessing into your life. Death and life are in the power of the tongue. So we've come to tell you tonight, be blessed. In fact, just look at three people around you, tell them, be blessed. Be blessed. Be blessed.
Be blessed, my brother.
somebody tonight. All of the hurt and the pain that you've gone through, God's got an answer for you tonight. You might be hurting.
You pray for me, and watch God change me. take some time out to pray for me. I know you're busy. I know you got a lot to do, but I'm gonna pray for you. And just watch God change me. Oh, if you just get on your lunch break, would you just take a moment out to pray for me? Because I'm gonna be praying for you.
Coming, but I know.